Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. Like most people, you've surely asked yourself, how can I make my dreams come true? How can I spend July in Baltimore? Well, search no longer. The 10th annual Baltimore Improv Festival runs from July 25th to the 31st. Sponsored by the Baltimore Improv Group. Come play in front of some of the largest, loudest, most supportive audiences you'll find at any festival in America. For more information and to register, go to BaltimoreImprovFestival.org. That's BaltimoreImprovFestival.org. And I've got some other good news for you. The 2016 Stumptown Improv Festival is now accepting submissions. The festival will take place from August 4th through August 6th in the lovely Portland, Oregon at the Arts Repertory Theater. Now in its third year, the Stumptown Improv Festival has already become legendary for its fully stocked green room, overstuffed gift bags, and complimentary hugs. Submissions are open until April 14th, so hop to it. Head over to StumptownImprov.com for more information. That's StumptownImprov.com. And don't forget, if you're in Chicago this summer, you are going to want to take my award-winning Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive. But you better act quickly, because I limit these workshops to 14 people, and I only offer Summer Intensive once a year. I will be offering two sections, July 29th and 30th, or August 6th through the 7th. Spots are filling up. To register, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We've got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Our guest today is writer, director, actor, and producer, Jon Favreau. He's the director of his new film, The Jungle Book, for Walt Disney Pictures. He's directed such movies as Iron Man 1 and 2, Elf, Maid, and Chef, just to name a few. He became a breakout star when he wrote and starred in the independent film Swingers with Vince Vaughn way back in 1996. Jon and I first met back in the late 80s at the Improv Olympic, now IO Chicago. He studied with legendary guru Del Close and went through the Second City Training Center twice. He worked at the Second City as both a dishwasher and a host. His rise to one of Hollywood's most successful directors, producers, writers, and actors is a pretty inspirational story. As I remember it, he didn't have things come easy to him here in Chicago in the improv community. He didn't get hired by Second City or The Annoyance. He did get one of his first big breaks, and that was being cast as a second lead in the film Rudy. Eventually, he moved to Los Angeles, and with the success of Swingers back in 1996, he's been working steady ever since. So, if you're at a theater and you can't get on a Herald team, or you can't get in a show, or you feel the gatekeepers are keeping you down, you're going to love to hear this interview. Here it is, the Jon Favreau episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd.
So I found out last night you did the set at Second City.
Kind of, yeah. I went up. I intro'd them, and I took suggestions for them. So I was definitely on stage with people who were a lot sharper and more experienced than I was.
How is that for you? Because when we started out together, Second City was the center of our universe.
Yeah, sure.
And you didn't get hired. I certainly didn't get hired.
Yeah.
So now you go
back. But I worked there. Remember?
You did. You were a dishwasher.
I got to town. I was a dishwasher. I sold T-shirts. I was a host. I went through the training center twice. So I was really, and I had auditioned. So it was a big deal for me. And it was strange because although I lived here for whatever it was, 4 years, I don't have family here. I don't come back here unless I'm coming through on something like this. So it really is like visiting your old school. And it was, it had an impact on me. Plus, it's so different now, too. But it's also the same, but none of the same people, very few of the same people are there. But yet the culture is very much the same, and the improvisers were wonderful. So it was nice. You know what was nice about it? It was nice to go up on stage, surprise the audience, and say hello. Talk
you get
for
a
minute.
You got a huge response.
Oh, sure. Because right. I remember when I used to host there and people would come in. I was like, I remember how cool it was for me to be there. And what an impression that how much I remember when people would come through. So it was nice to go there, say hi to the people who work there, say hi to the people backstage, go on stage, say hi to the audience, but really stay out of the way of everybody doing their thing. You know, I was there. You know, you're kind of like a prop up there because it's like a musician who hasn't played in a while compared to these people who are just playing every night. They're like jazz musicians, and there you are, all rusty. But so I kind of knew how to fit in, to go up there, say hello, stay out of their way.
But the first time that you really, you had gone on after college, which you didn't finish college.
I didn't finish college.
So you go on this road trip, you get on your Harley. Right. This is back in the 80s.
Yeah.
You come to Chicago, and you end up at Second City, and that changes things.
I end up, it was actually, I think at, was it at the Tracks? It was an Improv Olympic show. I had a friend of mine, Brian, who lived here, and I visited him on the way home. And he took me to a show where he was performing, and I think it was the B team. I think it was Farley, and I think Myers was still around sitting with them.
Yeah.
And you know, I was watching the improv show, and I was really impressed. I thought it was super cool. But I kind of, at the back of my mind, thought it was pre-planned on some level because it felt too polished. So I wasn't totally buying that it was improv. And then they had me on stage to do The Dream. And The Dream was a game where they would interview somebody. And you would tell them what happened that day. And then they would improvise this kind of impressionistic long-form game where they would act out your day, your nightmare based on your day. So they were improvising, and Farley played me, and they were improvising my day. And I knew it wasn't fake because I just told them the story. Like, I wasn't a plant. And that's when I really became enamored with what a set of skills you could develop. And there was something about the people that were on the wall at Second City, the whole SNL crowd. I didn't realize all these people came from one place. And then generation after generation. And this was like right as I think Bonnie Hunt was getting hired. So it was even before the next few waves. It was before the Farley wave. It was before Tim Meadows.
Carell, Colbert before that.
Right. Oh, yeah. Carell, Colbert. All those people that... And I had the good fortune of being, you know, being a host, sometimes doing the main stage, sometimes being in the back for Bob Odenkirk's one-man show, set in the chair, Jeff Garlin. Of course, Carell and Colbert, who I think were out in Northwest at the time.
Yes.
And then watching them, Amy Sedaris, who I've worked with since. So just seeing these great people and then not knowing that these were, you know, just seeing these were just regular performers. It was very intimidating, to be honest with you, because these were people who hadn't made it yet and they were so good. And you show up here thinking you're going to be the funniest guy in town, and you show up and you're not.
But you always had confidence. You never let it, the thing that I admired about you is you never let rejection get in your way.
That's a nice way of saying it. It was a hard road because the doors weren't flying open for me. But I did get to perform, and the good thing about Chicago was that you could put up a show. You could get together with a bunch of people. It's like getting a band together. Get a space, get the back room of a bar. You know, if you're not looking to make dough, and you're willing to do a lot of work, you could write sketches. And it made me I find people who are writers, who consider themselves writers, sometimes have trouble committing to putting words on the page because it's so important. But when you're writing sketches for each week's show, you're just hammering out scenes one after the other. And you're not saying whether or not this is your life work. You're just doing something so you have material for the next week's show. And so doing sketch shows were important. Performing in other people's sketch shows. Watching other people's sketch shows and then watching people succeed and fail and do improv and take suggestions, you're just immersing yourself in it. And so I contend that the best part about being in Chicago is the beacon that these theaters serve as to draw people who have common passions. And then you pair up with those people. I think that happens with film schools a lot too, that people get drawn to film school because they love film. And next thing you know, you're meeting each other and networking, and then you're doing your own project. And so you end up succeeding in ways that you never thought would be your path, because you're putting yourself in a situation where you're open to those doors opening.
Well, and what I think also is interesting, and I just got to, for me, John, you are such an inspiration, because we talked a little earlier, you did not have it easy here in Chicago. You wanted to get hired at Second City, you wanted to get annoyance. It didn't happen.
But honestly, what was nice is I got to work with a lot of different people. And then I also got to, you know, by auditioning, I would get commercials and got in the union. And through the people that I knew, and everybody was very supportive. Like, it was not, what's nice about this scene is that because it's such a team sport, there wasn't, at least that I could remember, a lot of competitiveness in a way that was, other than people being competitive with good work that's being done, but nobody was pushing each other down. Ultimately, if you were on stage with somebody else that was good, you wanted to make that person look good, and they wanted to make you look good. That's the very basis of improv. It's the team sport mentality. And selfishness was never something that was rewarded. It was always knowing how to stick to the rules and following, especially with Dell teaching. It was never about getting the biggest laugh. It was always about doing the best move, the best strategy. You know, staying true to the underlying concepts that he was teaching. And a lot of that wasn't just about humor. It was about seeking truth out. It was about exploration, discovery, and having a disposition on stage where you were not fearful, where you were making strong choices, committing. And different teachers had different methods, but they all kind of had that one thing in common, that you were going for something bigger than the laugh. And that very thing becomes story, you know, when we become a writer. A lot of it, you know, as you work with people who are in development, sometimes they're going for a laugh in a scene, or they're going for an effect in a moment. But really, if you listen to the people who are great at it, I think especially of like the people who speak the most about it, like the people at Pixar, they say it's story. Story is always first. And what's story? Story is character development. Story is being true to the characters. It's being true to the honest truth of how things unfold, and making the story that you're weaving more important than any individual moments, and aspiring to something beyond just the gags or the things that people gravitate to, and having the confidence that you'll get there anyway. And that was always what Dell had said. He said, if you're going for the truth, fun, you'll hit funny along the way. Even if you fall short, you'll get to funny.
And that's what I appreciate about your movies. Be it Iron Man, you take a comic book character, there's humanity in the Robert Downey character.
Thank you.
Even Jungle Book, in the CGIF animals, there's humanity in it. Chef, one of my favorite movies.
Thank
that
you.
There's humanity in it. Does that come from working with Dell? Or where does that
know.
Come from?
I don't know where one starts and one ends. I know that Dell would definitely reward it. The crowds wouldn't always, because you're at the end of the day, you're going to a show to see comedy. Like, they want their laughs. But if you could be compelling, you were probably going to get laughs anyway. And I always liked the people. I think about Farley. He was hilarious, but he was so human in his performances, even when he played the broadest of characters. And I was lucky enough to be at Second City and watching him perform every night. And I think when you see his best stuff, you feel for him. You don't just laugh at him. You experience it through his eyes. And that's, you know, to me, that's what I respond to. But then I'm also a fan of movies, and those are the types of movies that I like. And I think that movies are ultimately a medium where you want to feel things as opposed to just react and be entertained by them. You want to be transported by them. And you don't always get to do that, but it's at least what you should aspire to. And I think Dell was... It's so hard to separate Dell from what I hear other people talk about Dell, because I only spent so much time with him.
Right.
But then you hear Tina Fey talk about Dell, or you hear McKay talk about... And so it kind of rounds out the experience of it. Because he really spoke in bursts. It wasn't like you were getting a lecture about
right.
about this stuff. You kind of catch moments when he would give you flashes of insight. And other teachers who worked with him also. But there was always a sense that you want to do something. Let's put it this way. Truth, finding the truth of something was more important than finding the funny of something. And that seemed to be the key that unlocked a lot of doors. At the time, honestly, I'm just, you know, How do you teach me how to be funny? Teach me how to be a good performer. Teach me to be special.
But then there's also the part that teach me how to write a screenplay. When I saw Swingers, because when you were here, I just remember you as the improviser, and I was blown away because it was such a great script, and it was, again, it was a human experience. It was you, LA, dealing with a breakup.
Right.
How did you take that pain and then turn it into something great?
It was, you know, again, I think the improv training was a foundation in that you're always looking for what's the game in the scene. What's the game? What's the scene about? This is a scene, you know, leaving a message on the answering machine. This is the game of that scene was, can I live out a whole relationship one-sided just with phone messages?
Now, was that true? Was that based on a
true?
No, okay. Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Most of it wasn't true. What was true was I was, you know, I had moved out to L.A. Mm-hmm.
This was after Rudy and you had done PCU.
Rudy.
And things weren't happening, right?
No, it wasn't happening. But I also thought that I had made it big because, you know, being cast in Rudy from here was one in a million.
You were the second lead in a movie.
Yeah.
Cast out of Chicago. I don't think
right.
that's ever happened.
It's very rare. You know, I was doing extra work before then. You know, I was getting little day parts in movies. It was starting to come into my own.
You had also gotten a couple commercials, I remember. Something for like ComEd.
Yeah. And I got, you know, and I got my SAG card through that. So it was, I was doing well, and I was doing well enough to pay the bills. But then Rudy happened, and that was really special. It was a really great experience. I got cast, and right away I was in South Bend, and there I was for many weeks, and I would go to the set every day.
Were you nervous? Were you scared? Because here it is, you're the second lead in a movie. You had just done 12 Angry Men, I believe, play.
Right, right.
So it's like you don't have a lot of experience on a set for a second lead. Was there any fear?
No, I never, you know, because I knew that I had, you know, it's such, you get such chops from being on stage so often and bombing and then doing well and then bombing and doing well. It's like you become a veteran. You don't get into a film set is so supportive compared to being on stage with a bunch of people who don't even know so often that you're going to be up there. You know, they're just there. And some people don't even know there's going to be a comedy show. You know what I mean? You have some of those gigs. You know, people want to have a beer and drink, and now you're up there saying, I'm going to make up some scenes for you. Kind of a suggestion of occupation, please. You know, there's improv everywhere here. And not all of it's great. And, you know, and most of the stuff I did wasn't great, you know, because you're learning. But when you go to a film set, now all of a sudden it's like, how do I, you're not just saying, how do I enter a scene with nothing? You see the scene written. Remember, we were also auditioning a lot, so you're always looking for opportunity. You're reading a lot of scenes and pages of dialogue that often aren't, you know, that can be improved upon. And you're always looking as a character actor for how do I bring something cool to this? How do I paraphrase this? Sometimes they let you, you know, go off book a little bit. And the people I knew were funnier than a lot of the scripts I was reading, certainly for commercials and stuff. And so I knew that the people, you know, that was a chance to hit the ball. And so that was, you know, that was part of it. And I think when I went to the set, I knew I could do the scene, you know, and act in it. And then I could often make some funny choices that would make the director laugh. And then I really felt great about myself.
Where do you get that confidence?
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't, you know, it was definitely, there was a lot of humbling experiences here. Anytime you go on stage is humbling. But it was nice because even in the areas where you'd think it would sap your confidence because you just can't seem to, it's just slow motion and it's just all, you feel like you're hitting every branch of the tree as you fall out of it. And, you know, but there's such a, it was always taught, all the improv teachers would say, commit, don't bail. Like that was the worst thing you could do is like sneak away. The more you got scared, the more you had to dive into it. And so you would start to appreciate, even if a team was bombing, you'd see the people who were just completely selling it. And so there was an honor in a glorious failure. And then you had a team of people around you. It wasn't like you just went up there with a routine and you bombed. You're all sitting around there having a beer together and saying, oh my God, you did this and I did that. I thought, you know, so you have this, you get to commiserate with people. And I think that it seasons you. I think that that type of on your feet training seasons you. And but I don't know. I always felt like I always was very optimistic with this stuff. Even now, like, I'm getting ready to do this Jungle Books. I'm working on this thing for 3 years. It's the first time I'm talking to people who've seen the thing as I'm being interviewed and doing press. And I could be walking right into a, you know, into a 2x4 coming my way. I don't know. But I just have something makes me feel, I guess, excited that I'm excited about it and excited to finally see an audience see it. Because, you know, we used to go on stage. You go up there and it'd be real time. Now it's like you work and work and work and nobody sees any of it. And then it's completely done. And then you put it out there and everybody sees it. And so it's this really weird bifurcated experience where you don't get any feedback. And then you get to sit in the back of the theater and you don't have to do any work whatsoever.
Do you get anxiety and fear around, oh, what are the critics going to say?
I definitely don't like when they don't like it. But I don't feel that feeling in a way. It's not like in the movie Chef where I get...
I love that scene in Chef.
Yeah,
and I, if you could just talk about it for people that haven't seen the movie.
So in the movie Chef, he reads a critic... he does a meal. A critic comes in, like the critic.
Like a New York Times, like he's going to make or break the restaurant.
With restaurants, as with theater, one critic could close the show or make you, or lines out the door. You know, I remember like 1200 Men, the Tribune liked it, and we sold out the rest of the run. You get the little like certified recommendation, the star, and all of a sudden the theater community in Chicago was so supportive and wonderful that if there's any sense that you might be doing something interesting, they will come in flocks, which is
right.
Incredible right. And unique, and I can't stress enough how important that is in the development of the artists here, that community. But in this, you know, and movies, by the way, aren't this way anymore. It used to be maybe with Siskel and Ebert, thumbs up, two thumbs up, they were important. Now, because of Rotten Tomatoes, it's an aggregate, it's a number, it's a percentage. It's not like one individual review makes or breaks any movie. And honestly, there's a lot of movies that do really well that don't have, that the critics don't connect with. But in the food business, it is a huge deal, as with theater. And so this guy rips this guy apart. And
your character.
The character that I play.
And you're in the restaurant when this happens.
I'm so mad, and I read it, and it's killing the character. And finally, he finds out that, you know, he has the guy come to cook him another meal. He gets fired. The guy shows up. They serve the old food. He starts ripping into him on Twitter, and then my character sees that he's there, and he rushes over and just goes into a huge tirade where he rips him apart and says, you know, just everything that any artists has ever said about critics, and not realizing that how telling it is about the insecurity of the artist, because they project all this onto the critic. And the critic, ultimately, if you haven't seen the movie, ends up being a pretty decent dude, and was actually, it was a bit of a wake-up call of, he should never have been serving the food he was serving, and it got the guy to step up his game. But the rant that he goes on is this emotional, crazy, freeing, you know, just completely venting. And I didn't, you know, I hope you didn't read it as it was not meant to be a polemic against critics, because actually I kind of agree more with the critic in that scene than the character is playing.
But when I watched it, what I got from it was either Johnny has this fantasy that he's wanted to do that before,
yes, no.
or it happened to him.
No, it was neither, actually.
Okay.
It's more a funny opportunity of playing the game of the scene of where does this have to go to? How do you heighten this till it transforms to the next thing? And the heightening is make him actually in the room being filmed doing this, because it comes right before the low point in the movie when he transforms.
And the heightening is he gets more and more upset.
Yes.
Emotionally.
And publicly.
Heightened. Yes.
And he shames himself by being so aggressively vulnerable out of pain and aggression out of insecurity, when he's pretending to be super confident, but really it's masking that he's really questioning deep down if he's on the right path. And so it serves kind of the same purpose in some ways as in Swingers, the answering machine message, when he completely makes a fool of himself by leaving too many messages. But it's always about heightening and transforming.
But what I loved about your character in Swingers, and also your character in Chef, And tell me, maybe I'm projecting because I'm lonely and sad. There's always a lonely and sadness element to those to your character.
Yes.
And I love that. Where does that come from?
I think that's the, I don't know. I think that's the thing, man. I think that we feel alone. I think people ultimately, there's a tension between love and togetherness and loneliness and being an individual, being isolated, isolation versus community. And that's what romantic movies are about too. Breakup movies. I think that that's part of our, I think there's only a few themes that we really all wrestle with. One of them is isolation versus community. Certainly Jungle Book's about that. And another one is faith versus fear. Like those are the things that, that dominate my concerns. They could usually fall into one of those two categories.
With all your success, do you feel lonely at times? You have three kids, a beautiful wife.
Yeah, I'm very grateful of what I have. But your circumstances don't always dictate your feelings. You know, it's, you have a whole history of being a person.
That's good for me to know.
Yeah, but I'm happy to say that my life fits, I've tailored my life to fit around what I enjoy most.
Which is what?
Which is feeling, getting lost in other people, getting lost in projects, losing your identity. When you work on a movie like Jungle Book, you're working with thousands of people. And you're working with artists, and you're working with actors, and you're working with musicians, and you're working with animators. And you, as a director, have to be in service to the big project. It takes your identity away. You completely infuse yourself into it, and you learn everything you have to learn, and you pour into it, and then you try to make each actor, you know, their best. So you just, you know, you're outside of your own individual needs and you're serving something bigger. And that's it makes for the best project. And that's also relates kind of to improv with the group mind thing. When, you know, the people who are up there, a lot of times people first come to town, I was probably guilty of it too. You're up there and you're trying to shine.
Right. Stand out, be the funniest.
Right, isn't that what draws people to showbiz?
Yes.
They want to be, you want approval.
Yes, yes.
You want the laugh, you want people to tell you
you're great.
But I
never got that with you.
Oh, you're being very kind. I'm sure I was that way. Everybody wants to be. Everybody thinks that they're funny or they're good, and they come here. And then you're around other people who are really, really good. And you start to study with the teachers who are experienced, who know where you're coming from. It's a lot like a martial arts class. You're not going to be an ass kicker. Don't come here to... Martial arts is not about being the toughest guy. It's about discipline. It's about rules. It's about a culture. And improv is very much like that. It's about the rules of sticking to the rules of the game and working together as a team. And together, you're going to come up with something that's synergistically better than you could as separate individuals. And that's sports, too. That's a great, right? That's a great sports movie. That's like a Hoosiers. You know what I mean? You, how do you grow bigger by being part of something greater than you? And it's lessons that we have to learn over and over again, and each situation dictates that. And as a director now, I get to be more of a coach. And that's what's fun. Because I get to perform, I get to do cameos for friends or do little things here or there or do voices in Jungle Book. And it still is fun to, you know, there is still part of me that loves to be the guy, the ham on the stage at the school play. But the more fun part is to find like a kid like Neil Setti from this.
He was great.
Thank you.
And the thing is, with a movie like this, it all comes down to the kid.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I do. It comes down to watchability. You know, it comes down to that. I smiled when I saw his tape. He'd never auditioned for anything. This was something his parents got a flyer. And he came in and went on tape. And it was like, wow, this kid's good. Like, I like looking at him. And I could teach him. He already is interesting. I can teach him the nuts and bolts of being on a set. And so what's really fun now, and oftentimes, I remember, I think when I was here, it was during Phil Jackson was coaching
the Bulls.
The
three peats,
right?
Yeah.
And you know, and I was lucky because I was here before they were champions. I was here when Jordan was scoring ridiculous amount of points, but they couldn't make it through the playoffs.
No one's going to accuse you of being a Fairweather fan.
Right?
Right.
And you'd watch him on TV every day. It was it made me, I never watched basketball before, but here I was, I had this guy, you know, perhaps the best ball player of all time is playing every day after, you know, and so I started watching, and it was interesting watching how the coaching affected the team and how recruitment and how his score went down, but the team did better. And that was, you know, that applies to a lot of things. That was what was really interesting about, as the whole city went through that experience of watching the team become champions under the tutelage of Phil Jackson.
But you talk about that. You talk about when you started, and we all were the same way.
Yeah.
Look at me.
Yeah.
I got to be. I need the approval for myself that I'm going in the right direction.
Yeah.
How did that evolve for you?
Because you start to fall in love with the whole thing, and you want to give back to the whole thing, whether the whole thing's the movie, or the whole notion of storytelling. And as you work with people who are coming up, and you become more of a parent and a mentor, and less of a student and less of a child, you switch hats. And part of it's from being a parent too, is you can help people avoid stumbling blocks. You can't eliminate mistakes, but you can help. The tremendous satisfaction is gained from watching things, people reach their potential and find fulfillment. And sometimes it's great because it's on a project you're working on too. It's like you're doing, I'm making a movie, Iron Man, but and so it's a big thing for me to do a movie like this and to succeed at it. But at its core, it was the relationship I had with Robert, who was really at the cusp of having this explosive growth in his life. And to be part of that experience was echoed by the movie, but that relationship that we developed through the thing was, in many ways, just as exciting. So it's a strange thing because it's about, I'd say, I was working with Jeff Bridges, right, on Iron Man. Jeff Bridges was a guy who I knew and I revered and loved. And one of the great things about Jeff Bridges is that he's exactly what you hope he would be. Like, if you had a dream that you were hanging out with Jeff Bridges and you had, like, the ideal version, and that's really what it's like. And so Jeff Bridges, we're making Iron Man. And Iron Man was a bit of a, you know, was not the most predictable, orderly experience. There was a lot of improv. There was a lot of rewriting on the set. The script wasn't quite in the shape I would have liked.
It was really stressful.
It was stressful.
And it's a big budget.
It was a big thing for me. As Marvel's first movie, if I screw this up, they would, you know, it was hard not to feel the heat on that one. And then it was also Robert who was like, you know, he wasn't the first choice, and I, you know, so there was a lot of things where I was really, I had a lot on the line there, and then you don't have enough time because even though it's a big budget, you don't have enough days, and you don't have this, and you didn't get this shot, and I want to go home and plan the next day, And Jeff Bridges is like, hey, come to my trailer after rap. Come on. You know, we're going to make making martinis up. His stand-in was there shaking martinis. He said, sit down. Have a drink. And there I am trying to pretend I'm relaxed, sitting in his trailer.
Because you're a little intimidated?
Because I got a million things to worry about. The last thing I want to do is chill out. And I love Jeff. And I love talking to him on the set and about the thing, but this wasn't a rehearsal. This wasn't a.
You're thinking about 10 different things you've got to do.
Tomorrow, I got to do all this stuff. We're behind and I got to talk to Robert. And so I sit down in his trailer, mixes a martini, and he says to me, you know, and he's pouring it. So now I'm starting to feel good. Now I'm starting to feel like, wait a minute, I'm in Jeff Bridges' trailer hanging out. He asked me to hang out with him, and they're making me a martini. Like, this is one of those moments I want to kind of remember because this is really what it's, you know, this is a moment that's special. And he says, you know, this is it. This is the thing. He goes, the movie, that's just the skin of the snake. But this, what we're doing now, this is the real thing. And you know, he kind of went on to explain even more what he meant, which is that, you know, it's the interaction of the people. It's the experience that you're having together. It's the creation of this thing. And then by the time the movie actually comes out, it's a year later. You're on to the next thing. You remember it. It's like a facsimile of what you did. But for the people involved, the living aspect of it was the experience of doing it. And the movie itself is is a symbol of it. And it's the thing that you think it's all about when you start. But then you start to realize, no, it's about the experiences that you're having with these people. And if you have a good experience, the movie will come out good too. But what you really remember, and I work with a lot of actors who don't even look at the movies.
What do you mean don't look at the movie?
They don't watch the film. Maybe they see it once. They don't enjoy watching the work. They enjoy doing the work. So I find with the people who are very creative and very good that it's really about doing it. And honestly, that's, you know, in that way it does connect back with all the things that the good improv teachers would teach, which is, you know, the here and now, listen, be there for your partner, and be in the moment. That's the big thing. Listen and be in the moment. And whenever I would do bad in improv, it was because I had something in mind or I thought I had a great idea that I thought of. And when it worked best is when you don't even remember what happened and you're just reacting. You're watching other people react. And the best people are the ones that are, you know, almost magically intuitive about what happens, and it's not a conscious thing. And so it does give you some clues as to the creative process. The creative process should be one of presence and mindfulness. That's also, you talk about chef. That was what was cooking was so fascinating to me, is that you had to completely concentrate, but you were so focused on what you were doing, you almost couldn't think. You had to focus on your knife work, otherwise you cut yourself, or, you know, you're dealing with heat. You don't want to burn yourself. And so if you are peeling shallots, you have to be completely mindful of that. And it became very, it was a really cool practice, almost a meditative practice. And the chefs that I met would all bond on that they loved the focus of it. And much like us, they care deeply about if the people they serve the food to like it or not. Like, that's the weird double bind there, which is, as a writer, as a director, as a chef, you are completely invested in your own vision of the thing. And if somebody says do it differently, you become very offended and like, I know what the scene should be, I know what this dish should be. But if you serve it to people and they don't like it, you will rethink it immediately. Whether it's a joke in a movie that doesn't play, or if it's a dish that people leave over.
So you're listening.
Oh, sure. It's very.
You're not, I'm the director, and this is how it goes. You're listening.
You are a little bit. If the studio says, hey, cut this scene, you're like, are you kidding? The whole thing is about the scene. But then people, like, go to the bathroom during a scene and a test screening. You're like, let's look at that scene again. So it's like the audience is always king. And that's what's interesting and, I think, different about people who are performers, people who are chefs also, filmmakers. At the end of the day, they are not. I can only speak for myself. I'm not fully satisfied if the audience isn't satisfied. And I could be as happy as I can be with a movie, but if the audiences don't connect and don't feel something, it feels like you've thrown a message in a bottle into the ocean and nobody found it. It's a very sad ending for me. I really like it when I put on a show and people enjoy it. Like, that's the thrill.
We got to wrap this up.
Okay.
Two quick questions, because they're, you know, we're over time.
Okay.
Are we going to get in trouble? Am I going to get in trouble?
No, as long as I make my flight, we'll be fine.
Okay, great. One was working with Bill Murray. He has such
yes.
a reputation,
oh my God, yeah.
you know, of coming in, improvising the script,
yes.
throwing it away, rewriting
yes.
it. What was it like working with him?
Well, I mean, fortunately, he had worked with Dell. I had worked with Dell, so I kind of had a sense of
Did you bring that up with him?
I did, you know, but it was more me knowing where his priorities were. He's always a guy who struck me as somebody who was wanted to be authentic, that he was, you know, that there was a, because he's, in, you know, on the one hand, he's very hard to get a hold of, hard to pin down, hard to get to commit to a project.
Well, I've heard directors are surprised when he shows up because you don't have confirmation.
You don't, but I had spoken to people who worked with him in the past. They said, oh, he said he's going to be there? Oh, yeah, he'll be there.
Right.
So you had to be like, okay. It was really about faith, you know.
Right.
Like, he says, what is it? Yeah, well, hold on a second. What is it, Thursday? What time? Okay. All right. Yeah, I'll figure it. I can get a flight. I'll get it. You want us to book it? No, I'll figure it out. And then he shows. And then I get scared, and I talk to, like, the director who worked with him. I said, no, that's good. You got him. He's going to show up. So there's a little of that. So there's a little bit. And then, plus, he's, you know, unpredictable and will go out and hang out with you and it's like my favorite year a little bit. Like, you get to sort of be in the wake of this incredibly compelling character who's, you know, who everybody who sees them is completely moved and struck by their presence. But he's also incredibly professional. So, like, he will do as many takes as you want. He will say, let's do this again. He'll say, can we come, let's do another session. Like, it's about the work for him. He wants it to be great. There is no phoning it in with this guy. So that was incredibly fulfilling. But the big thing is, I'm still standing there with Bill Murray. Like, that's not lost on me. Like, I'm so, and I don't know that he ever hung out a lot when I was working at Second City. I certainly didn't spend any time with him. I think I may have met him, but it wasn't like he was one of the people who was hanging around a lot. So I still had this big starstruck feeling. I still do when I'm around him. And I have to direct the guy, but
how do you do that?
Well, it's like giving a suggestion. You know, I direct him like you would an improviser. I'd be like, here's what it is, here's the parameters, go for it. And pushing him to go further, many of the best lines in the film are improvised, and I just had to set up a structure whereby which he could make up, left him room to improvise where I could make the movie fit. He didn't have to just fit like a into little holes in the movie that I had already planned. I had had him recording before I had committed to a lot of stuff visually so that I could then, and I brought the kid with me, right? So Neil Setti was with me, and that was incredibly valuable because him talking to a kid is a lot different than him talking to me or just to the air.
Right, so for people that don't know, a lot of times the actor will just go in and sure. record their part.
Yes, when yeah. I've done it, that's how you do it. Right. You book everybody separately. I wanted to get everybody in one room together. That was impossible. But I was able to bring them together. I was able to get Walken and Bill Murray together. I was able to get Neil Setti and Bill Murray together. I was able to get Neil and Ben Kingsley. So what I didn't want was a big, energetic, animated character performance. What I wanted was conversational acting that would work with the photoreal animals. And so there's a lot of back and forth with Bill Murray. And then we had his track. And then I would bring in puppeteers would act out from the Jim Henson Studios. They would build puppets for us, and we had performers that we got from them. And so they would listen to Bill's performance and do it on the set. So you get the spontaneity of the kid performing on the set with a puppet that's doing Bill's dialogue. And if we discovered anything new, because the puppets are improvisers too. Very similar to the tradition here, the puppet culture is very similar to the improv culture.
Right. Less drinking, I think.
and then you would have them, I'd throw different ideas to them, and if we got something interesting out of Neil, I would then go back to Bill and re-record, show him the film like you would with looping or ADR, and have him fit his dialogue in. But all of this was meant to make it completely invisible and feel spontaneous and feel like it was just an indie movie where people were just talking over each other.
Really quick, this is the last question. Mm-hmm. What piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out in improv today?
Oh, well. I think the most important thing is, and this is not something I expect people to understand, but just to hear. I thought I was coming here as a like waiting room to get discovered or a way to present myself to people who could tap me on the shoulder and take me on a ride of a career to be plucked out to be on in a certain company or on a certain TV show or a certain and I think in retrospect it looks like that's exactly what happened, right? With Rudy, I got plucked out and got discovered, and there's in the dreams all came true from that. And there's truth to that. But the fact of the matter is, if I had not been working for those 4 years before that happened, and all the things that I thought were tough breaks that I wasn't getting lucky, it's kind of the worst thing that happens is if you get lucky too early. And I was very lucky that it balanced out just right so that the breaks come just enough to keep me going. And each one's a little bit better than the last one, and I'm able to build on things from project to project. But it's been gradual. It's sometimes hard when you get too big of a break too early because you're not ready. And there are skills that you're learning, and you're getting seasoned in ways that you don't even understand. And you're getting to watch and observe other people and be an apprentice, even though you don't realize you're being that, and a student to these mentors that are great. You know, there's such a great pool of teaching talent here. And I say here, meaning in the improv community, I'm sure.
Which is expanded.
It's expanded out with UCB and all the people that can, you know, and so you have it in New York, you have it in LA, you have it in Toronto, you have it in, I think.
You have it all over the world.
You do.
Yeah.
So I don't mean Chicago specific, I'm saying, because I did it here. But the things that you think are setbacks or disappointments are really part of a bigger journey. And you are learning things that you're going to need, even though you don't understand it. And even today, I could be in a visual effects meeting looking at a bit that's supposed to be comic relief and looking at pages that came in and are not funny, and I have to make a scene funny. And I know that there are certain rules, like heighten and transform, that will get you to funny. Like, there's a bag of tricks that I have that if a scene's not working, I can give direction to the actors in much the same way I would as a coach of an improv team, that you have certain things that you know are going to lead to making a scene compelling, keeping it from being, what do you call it? I think you say it's too linear, it's not heightening enough. Like, there are certain rules that come from improv that aren't just for improv. They're for writing, they're for filmmaking, they're for editing, being in the editing room, and knowing what lines to cut out of scenes, how to rewrite things. You know, that all comes from refining a sketch or being paid, everybody throwing a buck in a hat to have me coach their improv team and watch their performance and giving notes afterwards, or watching, you know, realizing why we bombed or why we did good that night. And all those little things, they don't come quick. They take a while to sink in. You have to have, you know, your fair share of failures and successes to be able to really metabolize those rules to the point that you can draw upon them. And then once you have all that, and you know where the laugh's going to come, you could be on a set with no audience, and you know where the laugh is, and you could hear the laughter. You know, you can get timing down. You understand what the audience is always there sitting on your shoulder because you've had the experience of being in those situations. And it's that awareness of how what you're doing is going to be received that really helps color a performance, whether you're a film actor or if you're a director or a writer, helps you understand and connect with the audience that isn't there yet.
Jon Favreau, thank you so much.
My
pleasure. Film is Jungle Book.
Let me say about you also, because
okay.
You've been talking about me a lot.
Okay.
You were here before I got here.
Yeah.
You were, I remembered you as being the most open, accepting, supportive person of everybody that came through here, both your peers, but also the newcomers. Like, there was nobody who ever, and you're exactly the same now. You look exactly the same. You've got the same, you know, great, open energy. But you were always, you always had a nice thing and supportive thing to say. And it was so important because that's a time when that you really, you need it. Because people are questioning everything they're doing. They're so insecure. You say, I seem confident, but at the time, you question everything. So it was very nice, and I remember it, even though it's going back over 20 years, I remember distinctly that, and it was always fun to watch you perform. That's an easy one to say. You always had something interesting. You were always an improviser, and people always enjoyed what you did because you would always do something interesting and unexpected. But more importantly, I think, you were always supportive and nice, and your agenda always felt like it was to connect with the person you're talking to and be supportive of that. So thank you for that.
Thank you, John.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Jon Favreau, and go and check out the movie, The Jungle Book. Also, I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, we are taking over social media, as you know, so follow us on our Improv Nerd Facebook page and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter at @improv_nerd, and go to our YouTube channel, Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, The Artist's Low Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. We're also lucky enough to be part of a podcast collective called feralaudio.com. They've got some wonderful podcasts, people like Dan Harmon, Chelsea Peretti, Steve Agee, Matt Dwyer, Todd Berry, Jimmy Corain. I love throwing my name in there for no reason. Go to feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank both my sponsors, the Baltimore Improv Festival, and for more information, go to baltimoreimprovfestival.org, and the 2016 Stumptown Improv Festival. Go to stumptownimprov.com for more information. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.